Will Hulk Hogan ever come back to the WWE in some form or fashion?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
I mean, wrestling, there's never the end in wrestling, you know? I mean, we're talking about Piper's Legends contract. I mean, I was going to, like, from what I know, sort of from Piper's side, he and Vince hate each other deeply. But I would really kind of have a hard time reporting that as like a concrete fact, because like it wouldn't surprise me at all if he were still alive to see them hugging at WrestleMania next year.
Welcome back to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where we interview members of the sports media about their work and interesting people about the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. Also, Jamie Lasante will produce some of this podcast. Today's guest is David Shoemaker. He is the Grantland wrestling writer, and he is terrific at what he does. I would say he's almost more of an essayist than a writer, somewhat of a journalist, but not sort of a pure journalist. But he writes about wrestling in such an interesting and fascinating way to me, where combines history, combines his own personalization about how he feels about sports entertainment, and then also just gives you like a sense of what this is about and why it's important in culture. And if you don't think it's important in culture, just look at the numbers that Raw gets every week. 3 million, 4 million people watching this. WrestleMania sells out, you know, 90,000, 100,000 seat arenas. It is a major, major thing. David recently wrote a tribute to the late Roddy Piper, which I would recommend. It's just incredibly great writing. It's on Grantland right now. He's certainly written about Hulk Hogan and Hulk Hogan's troubles. So he's a really interesting guest. I've been wanting to have him on this podcast, and I'm psyched that he's going to do it. He also has his own podcast, Cheap Heat, which gets probably 15 times more viewers or listeners than this one. We thank you for the great feedback for this podcast. Last couple of guests have been Bomani Jones and Ian Dark of ESPN, Mike Mayock of the NFL Network. We love hearing from listeners. You can get in touch with me on Twitter at Richard Deitch, RichardDeitsch. Send us any suggestions for future guests or questions you want answered, criticism, complaints. Please, if you like this show, share it with your friends. And, of course, you could subscribe to us on iTunes, the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, David Shoemaker is the guest. He is in New York. Without further ado, let's bring him on. Okay, as promised, we bring in David Shoemaker of Grantland, the fine wrestling writer. He is in New York, so interestingly enough, as we tape this podcast, he's probably within 8 miles of us. David, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I kind of, I always feel like I'm the writer who's sitting at the kids' table, so I don't really know what I'm doing here, but I really appreciate the invitation.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're only here, David, because 26 other people turned us down. So. No, you are here because, as people who read me know, I'm a huge wrestling fan. It's one of my sort of escapist hobbies. I've been watching it for a long time, on and off, not consistently, but on and off since I was a teenager. And I think, David, what you do in terms of the quality of your writing when it comes to professional wrestling is just fantastic. So I'm really happy that you've jumped on the podcast. You have your own podcast as well, Cheap Heat. You certainly will talk about that a little bit. That's a great podcast I listen to a lot. But first off, I'm always interested in how people get into wrestling writing. There's a group of people who do it professionally, Dave Meltzer and some of the other sites, and they do it really well. You do something different to me. You're sort of a long-form essayist on the topic. But let's start from the beginning for you. You're obviously a fan, but how did you get into the writing of it?
It's a story I've told before, and it's a little bit winding. But I guess the short version is that I always wanted to be a writer, and I was an editor for a long time. And if anybody in the business knows, it's kind of hard to do both. There's not enough room in your brain for all those words. I had passed along some stories over the years about wrestling to at that point a friend of a friend, a guy named Tommy Craggs, who I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, who was working at Deadspin. And whenever there was an interesting wrestling story, I would just, you know, send an email because I was keeping up with the sport just enough to know when that stuff happened. And after a while, he came to me and he said, you know, these random stories are posting are getting tons of traffic all of a sudden. Will you just write something about wrestling for me? So there was a lot of back and forth, and it kind of, you know, through a weird process of me sort of having a co-writer for a minute that never actually ended up happening, and you know, that just going through the different ideas of what we thought could draw attention, we came up with this idea of Dead Wrestler of the Week, which was going to just be a sort of like tongue-in-cheek, you know, back of the trading card look at a different wrestler who had died every week, and it really quickly evolved into just these, you know, long-form eulogies. You know, what immediately interested me the most wasn't the joking around, but it was trying to figure out why these guys had meant so much to me. And, you know, that itself evolved into a bigger kind of a career-long project of sort of figuring out why, you know, where pro wrestling exists in the sports landscape, and you know, why it's a sort of offbeat American institution.
All right, there's a couple things there that I want to get into. First off, how often do you do firsthand reporting versus, for lack of a better phrase, sort of being an essayist on the sport?
I mean, it's mostly essay writing. you know, there's certainly some reporting, and there's definitely a lot of people that I, you know, that I keep in touch with that are sort of sources, for lack of a better word. But, you know, you mentioned, I think, Dave Meltzer. I mean, there's lots of guys out there on the internet, Wade Keller and Brian Alvarez. I mean, there's lots of people who are, you know, report news, and that's, you know, I don't really consider that my beat. Certainly, you know, there have been times where there's, you know, a specific story I want to tell, and reporting is part of it. But, you know, there's a couple of things that go into it. I mean, for one, the internet, you know, news cycle in wrestling is relentless, and you know, whereas, you know, I might get some clicks from breaking news. I mean, it's hard to keep up, and you know, keeping up is certainly not really my cut of tea. but you know, and also in the professional wrestling world, I mean, I think most importantly, 95% of what you hear is BS. I mean, even from people who are like telling you the truth, the wrestling world is just this incredibly bizarre situation, you know, bizarre parallel universe where the word they use in the business is kayfabe. I mean, it's the kind of the institutional lie that we all pretend this is real, and that has infected everybody's communication. Everybody puts themselves over. Everybody tries to make themselves look good. Everybody's trying to make, you know, every moment seem more exciting than it is. So even when you're reading news on the internet that somebody puts out there, it's not what any, you know, it's not what Richard Deitch would consider news, you know, in any other genre. So, you know, so I don't do a lot of that stuff. But yeah, I mean, and to me, I, you know, I feel like, you know, the essay writing is, you know, more reflective of the experience of watching wrestling in a certain way, because you just sort of give yourself over to it.
Do you consider, David, what you do journalism, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I'm lucky to have always worked with really, really good editors. Tommy Craggs, who I mentioned, and then at Grantland, Rafe Bartholomew and Dan Fearman, and there have been some other people who were involved, and they, you know, they take the journalism aspect of it really seriously. So, like, I in some ways feel like I have this great benefit where I could basically just be writing, you know, meditative poetry, and it would come out looking like something resembling journalism. But, you know, I mean, I think that basically what I do is, you know, is a thing that maybe only exists in the internet era, but that would only exist if, you know, because there's space on the internet, but there's more and more of it now, which is just sort of, you know, just essaying, I mean, essay writing and think pieces, and you know, there's definitely a journalistic aspect but it's hard to cover pro wrestling in a really concrete journalistic way. And so on some level, I hope that I'm getting to a, you know, a deeper truth about it by not just pounding the pavement and calling up road agents and getting their opinions.
How do you end up choosing the subjects for your column, and how much of it is dictated by Grantland editors?
Very, very little is dictated by Grantland editors. Certainly there are, I take that back. I get suggestions and requests all the time for things to write, but that usually falls kind of outside of what I consider my normal routine, which is sort of a piece before and after every pay-per-view. I mean, and those are mostly on me. And because of the, because there's not a lot of demands, I mean, it frees me to do whatever I want. But at the same time, it's sometimes I'm 5,000 words in before I figure out what I need to be writing about. Generally, I will watch. I mean, obviously, I watch every episode, but I watch an episode of Raw right before I write, and I write it with an eye towards what the most important thing for me to discuss is and what I can write about that and go into some detail on that I don't think everybody else is going to be writing about. I mean, and that's the other thing is I'm not a blogger. I'm not cranking things out in 30 minutes or 3 hours. So, I have to keep an eye to not just publishing a piece that will have already been written five times by the time my piece comes out. It's sort of all over the place on how I decide what the subject's going to be. As I'm really interested in wrestling history, so it's a lot of times it's these weird connections in my head where it's like if there's something that I want to write about anyway from 50 years ago that relates to what's going on now, those connections help make help keep me interested and hopefully the readers too.
As specific as you can, David, can you give the listeners a sense of how much wrestling you consume on a weekly basis and what you specifically consume?
It's all over the place. I watch Raw every week. Lately it's been watching Raw every week. I watch WWE SmackDown every week. I watch, the pay-per-views when they come on. I watch NXT. I go in binges where I watch, months of various other companies, Ring of Honor, and there's New Japan stuff that I have access to, and the Lucha is the new sort of like Robert Rodriguez Lucha show, new as in 2 years old, is just the most amazing thing. I mean, I love that stuff to death, but my beat is WWE. I mean, it's pro wrestling kind of overall, but I'm obligated to cover WWE at a minimum. I pay more attention to the other stuff when I was discussing before, when I feel like there's some sort of meta storyline that is roping all these things together.
And then what sources do you read on a daily or weekly basis?
Not a ton. There's a lot of different wrestling websites that sort of, bring all the various internet chatter together. I spend a lot of time I spend a lot of it on a Reddit page called The Squared Circle.
Yep.
Which does is a good, pretty good community as far as Reddit communities go. I mean, really smart users and stuff like that. And most of the information gets on there if I keep up. You can understand what I'm about to say. Like, I'm lucky to be in a position where most of the stuff that matters gets tweeted at me about, by one of my readers about 5 seconds after it breaks. So, thankfully, I'm able to keep up with most things just by staying plugged in.
I want to talk about Grantland for a second because it's you really, like myself, you're at a unique forum where you get read by a lot of people. You get some authenticity because of Grantland's the respect that people have for Grantland as a very smart place when it comes to writing and thinking. So you did pieces for Deadspin, worked for Tommy Craigs, obviously a very, very smart guy. So Grantland obviously saw something in your writing and they wanted you. How did you first initially come to Grantland? Did Bill Simmons pursue you specifically, or what's the story behind that?
Well, I mean, part of it was, I mean, I think the initial connection was through Crags when he was, when there was that brief moment where he was talking about working there. Right. But then they pursued me. There was a couple different voices involved. But Dan Fearman, who I mentioned before, and of course Bill Simmons was one. Initially there was some talk that they just wanted me to do things like Dead Wrestler of the Week over there, and then it was Simmons who came down and said, no, you know, Shoemaker needs to cover contemporary wrestling. I want someone to cover wrestling week to week in a really smart way, like you're reviewing a sport / scripted TV show. Which was nothing I had ever particularly thought about. I was totally into it. But it was Bill who kind of set the course for what I would be doing at Grantland, and he made the right call. It's been a fun ride.
When did he come and meet with you in person? Did that happen by phone?
That was all by phone. I know that when he was getting the crew together for Grantland, he did make some in-person pitches, but I just talked to him on the phone a number of times, and I ended up meeting him shortly thereafter, but that was, I didn't need any in-person convincing to come write for Grantland.
And you're a contract writer for them? You're under contract, and is that an exclusive contract, or could you work elsewhere in addition to Grantland?
As of very recently, it is an exclusive contract in terms of pro wrestling writing, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, and if you don't want to say this, I understand, but I think people would be interested. Are you signed with them for multiple years? Will we be seeing your writing on there, let's say, through 2016?
I mean, I just signed a new contract, so you can kind of assume whatever you want from there.
Great. Okay. I want to ask a couple quick questions about Simmons, understanding that you have to be Kofi Annan here in terms of...
No, I mean, I don't... You can ask away, by all means.
Great. Don't be the opposite of Kofi Annan. Diplomacy is dead. Bill Simmons is a huge wrestling fan. We see that on Twitter. I've talked to Bill many, many times. It's something we share in common. Now that he has departed Grantland, that is a very big proponent of wrestling writing who is gone, not just to mention the fact that it's sort of the figurehead of the site and the editor-in-chief of the site, but it's someone who is a real passionate supporter of what you do, gone. So first question, what have you been told about your content heading forward in terms of Grantland's interest?
Nothing real specific. I mean, there have been... I met Chris Connolly, the new editor, fairly shortly after he signed on. Literally ran headfirst into him in the hallway of the New York office when he was visiting, and he knew who I was and was very complimentary. And my obituary on Dusty Rhodes had just come out a couple days before, and he was very aware and complimentary of it, which is always nice when you're meeting a new boss.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's a different. I mean, Grantland is from the beginning was a really was just a sort of like blessed place. Simmons was an incredible boss, and had an incredible eye for talent, and really put together something magical. And I think that I, more so maybe than a lot of other people that work there, got really lucky for being involved, just because had he not decided wrestling was going to be a component, which, as you said, Simmons being in charge would have been crazy to think of, but had he decided not to have wrestling, I don't think anybody would have been screaming for wrestling content, and there weren't a whole lot of outlets at that point that would have been really great fits. I mean, the cool thing for me about working at a place like Grantland is that it calls itself a sports and pop culture site, and so there's not the inherent question of where does wrestling fit, because it's somewhere in between. And, I came from a place where, when I started writing at Deadspin, that first 6 months, every single piece I wrote, the comments were like, what the hell is this doing on this blog? and this is Deadspin. This is like, there's not, the rules are pretty loosely defined over there. I have always read guys like Dave Meltzer, who we talked about before, who are the kind of the vanguard of wrestling journalism.
Right.
But that was never, I mean, I never had any inkling to, like, or any inclination to be somebody like that. When, so just, I mean, getting the opportunity to work for Grantland was just made what I'm doing possible at all. Now there's more places that are doing stuff like that. I mean, Rolling Stone has a wrestling beat, and, you know, The Atlantic's published articles, The New Yorker. So since I started, there's been a lot of changes. But at the time, you know, I wouldn't exist without Simmons deciding to let me.
We're gonna get into sort of the what those changes at these other places mean. When the decision came that ESPN would not be retaining Bill, how unexpected that was that for you? But more importantly, did you worry at all about the possibility that this would mean something dramatically for your career at Grantland?
I mean, yeah, definitely, because I was negotiating a new contract at the time. Thankfully, I think that you know, I matter so little to the bottom line as far as, like, you know, the executives at Disney or whatever, that I don't think that they really cared enough to figure out that I was negotiating at the time. But who knows? But yeah, no, I mean, I did worry about it, but it's, you know, I mean, I think that they appreciate what they have in Grantland, you know, and as silly as it is that they have, like, a full-time wrestling guy or a regular wrestling guy anyway, that I'm part of the package deal, at least for now.
All right, and my guess is that was the Simmons news a surprise, or
yeah.
Or did you get the
I mean, I didn't know anything.
All right, you didn't get the script beforehand, basically. It wasn't a run through.
No, not at all. I mean, and I'm about as disconnected from you know, any sort of Grantland office culture as anybody whose name regularly appears on the site.
Right.
So it was a big shock to me.
I bet. I appreciate you answering that. You know, one of the things at Sports Illustrated that we found and we've seen for a number of years is a guy at Sports Illustrated named Andy Gray. He writes Hot Clicks, does a lot of special projects. He's a huge wrestling fan. And he was one of the people who recognized this many years ago that when you did wrestling content, the page views on it were through the roof. And the wrestling content that we would do at Sports Illustrated might be, you know, you sort of talk to Bret Hart, who might go through some of, like, his greatest matches of all time, or his relationship with Shawn Michaels, or, you know, you sort of revisit the day that Hogan, you know, joined the NWO and at Bash at the Beach and sort of turned the sport up. So this was something that you were ahead of, I think, as a pioneer in recognizing that people were interested in this content. So I have a number of questions off this. First off, why do you think that is, and have other places just not, and I'm talking about mainstream places, not been quick enough to realize that there is a gigantic audience out there who wants to read about this in the same way you want to read about NBA free agency trades?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, and I think there's a lot of reasons why it's you know, a big, why it's more common now than it was. I mean, I think, I'll start at the end. I mean, for one thing, I mean, there are fewer lines on the internet of, like, you know, like I was talking about people criticizing the stuff I would write for Deadspin before. Things are much less regimented now, you know, and I think there's more of an acknowledgement from readers that you know, different places will publish things because, I mean, for the reason of getting traffic, or because they want to, you know, there doesn't have to be a rubric for everything. And I think that in general in pop culture, we're at a place where wrestling is harder to criticize just because of the rest of the things that exist. You know, every wrestling fan grows up. We hear the one thing you hear over and over again is, you know that stuff's fake, don't you? As if that's the greatest insult someone could hurl at a wrestling fan, even though we actually, you know, are very aware that it's all fake, and that's entirely the point. But now we live in a culture where, like, you know, there's so much fake stuff out there, you know? I mean, you can't watch the Kardashians and then make fun of wrestling, or you can't cover the Kardashians and then decide not to have a wrestling writer, you know, for some moral reason. And it's not just reality shows. I mean, just the way that you know, politics is covered now is,
exactly,
you know, isn't that much different. So you know, I think that there are a lot of those things have changed. And the traffic is a real thing. You know, I mean, the more that there is, I think the less the traffic spike for wrestling will be as clear. I mean, just because it'll be more spread out. But, you know, like I said, those wrestling fans grow up getting made fun of a lot. And in some sense, I'm just speaking from personal experience, you're looking for validation as a wrestling fan. So when somebody like Sports Illustrated posts a piece online or writes a piece in the magazine, then every wrestling website's going to link to it because in some ways that's the validation that you know, we've been looking for as fans and that WWE is constantly looking for, trying to get back in the mainstream spotlight constantly since, you know, they were on MTV way back when.
Yeah, and the one thing that's very true is that the WWE, especially when a place like mine writes about wrestling, they will go out of their way to be helpful in terms of getting people on the phone, helping push that content, because it's interesting. I wrote a piece not too long ago about ESPN doing far more wrestling content in the last 12 months than they had ever done before, including having Rollins on, made the announcement that Lesnar was going to re-sign on their airwaves. And it's turned out to be a very, very smart move, and one that I would say I think traditional places like ESPN should do more of. Are you do you find that whether it's Rolling Stone and some of the other mainstream places that write about wrestling, is there do they write it in a different way than the traditional wrestling outlets like what Meltzer does? Is it Do you find that they're writing wrestling in the voice of their own publication, or some other way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit hard to find. So much of the wrestling writing that, especially if you're pointing at a thing that only exists as of the past year or two. I mean, the voice of the internet is a very unique thing, and it's kind of hard to pick exactly what's inspired it. Because the editorial hand is really strong on some of those things too. I mean, but yeah, I would say that Rolling Stone or whatever, any of these sort of newer, more mainstream online sources, online outlets, certainly owe as much to, you know, Television Without Pity as they do to Meltzer. But like I said, I think it's just more of a. I mean, it owes as much to everything they've ever read before, too. You know, I mean, it's like it's equal parts that, equal parts just sort of like the ironic, the detached voice of Gawker. And then the sort of like voice of hyper fandom that exists in places like Reddit and on sports blogs and stuff like that. So it's a combination of things.
To use a wrestling term, how do you know when one of your pieces gets over with the crowd?
You know, I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook, but when my Facebook mentions all of a sudden are crazy, that's one way. When I start getting tweets from people that are introducing themselves in the tweets or just, you know, clearly unfamiliar with anything I've written before, I know that that's big. Every once in a while I'll get an email forwarded from somebody, like somebody at Grantland will forward me an email from somebody more important that will be just like, can someone explain to me what's going on with this piece? But that's very rare. You know, that'll be like, I think the first time that happened was when the Ultimate Warrior died and I posted a piece about him. And I guess that's like a year and a half ago, and everybody was just sort of like, very confused. You know, I think I've done respectable traffic for Grantland, but there's nothing. I mean, the obituaries, which, you know, I'm blessed to be the sort of guy who people tweet or write to at certain times saying I can't wait to read the piece you're about to write. But being an obituary writer is not the most fun job in the world. But those things do draw a whole lot of eyes. So that's how I find out.
Yeah, and we'll get to the Piper piece that you wrote this week, although people will hear this podcast in a couple of weeks, which was really, really terrific and certainly an honorable tribute to a person who was my favorite wrestler. But, you know, along these same lines, when I asked people on Twitter if they had questions for you, a number of people came back with a question and sort of thoughts that were very, very similar around this question, and that is, how do you feel about writing about something which is responsible in part for some of the early deaths of these guys. And that's not to blame one person in wrestling or wrestling as a whole, but there obviously are a lot of wrestlers who have passed away early, whether it was steroid use, whether it was however they lived their lives on the road. But, you know, do you feel any kind of response? It's a weird thing. As a wrestling fan, are we supporting the bad vices of some of these guys for our own entertainment?
Coincidentally, I was talking about this on my podcast, Cheap Heat, the other day, when the Hulk Hogan scandal broke, that he had, you know, had that racist diatribe in the middle of his, or, you know, as part of his sex tape or whatever. Right. But when I was sort of mentally grappling with the Hogan situation, I realized what was really eating at me the most. I mean, I was like severely unhappy for several days, but what was eating at me the most was this feeling of culpability, right? That like you are, when you deal with something like race and wrestling and like the wrestler deaths you were talking about, there's a lot of different ways you can approach it. And there's a lot of different ways you can sort of like, you know, cordon off your feelings. But at some point you realize you're complicit in it. And that's the most painful thing. I mean, as a fan, it's your money that's propping up the business that's allowing this stuff to happen.
Right.
And specifically to the deaths, I mean, I was writing for Deadspin, and most of the people I was writing about were people who were not long dead, but, you know, who had died several years before. And I was not, you know, I was not, you know, dealing with those deaths in real time particularly. The first person that I wrote about, I think, was Chris Canyon, who was the first time I wrote about somebody like the day they died. And I was never a huge Chris Canyon fan, I mean, compared to other people. And he had a kind of a bizarre life for a lot of reasons. But I was just destroyed writing that piece. I mean, just having to deal with it so directly was really tough. And then when I wrote my book, which is The Squared Circle, I dealt with a couple of subjects. The Von Erich family, who I grew up as my, like, all of my idols were Von Erichs for a while in my life. Mm. And then the last chapter of my book is about Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero. Those two chapters were, those were heartbreaking. I mean, they were incredibly difficult to write. And anyway, I mean, there's these, you hit these subjects where they just hit you so directly, and you can't help but feel that you're partly responsible. I mean, especially like I was saying with the book. I mean, the Von Erichs were my early childhood, you know, and then Benoit and Guerrero died. I mean, that, you know, up to 20 years later, depending on, you know, where you want to start the clock on the Von Erichs. And that whole time, you know, I've been giving my money to WWE as a fan. So, like, yeah, it's a real thing that you have to struggle with. Now, I mean, I don't really know where you go from there, except, you know, I'd like to think that I helped, you know, shine a light on it. Certainly I wasn't anywhere near as big a voice as places like, you know, Real Sports on HBO or like whatever. I mean, there have been a lot of bigger, you know, mainstream fingers pointing at WWE, and WWE is not emblematic of the entire industry, except that they've sort of wrestled that mantle away for themselves, no pun intended. But they, you know, they've changed a lot to make things a lot better, you know, so WWE deserves some credit, and I think at least on equal ground with that, is that the bulk of professional wrestlers, of this generation of professional wrestlers, are people who grew up as fans, as opposed to the guys who were the most famous guys in the 80s. There were a whole lot of, like, football players who blew out their knee and you know, they didn't have reconstructive surgery the way they do now, and so they turned to wrestling to make ends meet, you know. And so the guys who are wrestlers now, you know, guys like Daniel Bryan or Seth Rollins, these are guys who grew up watching wrestling, and I think they've internalized a lot of what happened to their, I mean, these guys were their idols too. And so, you know, in some sense, there's a self-correction built into the industry. But how do I feel about it? I mean, there's times where I feel terrible about it. And there's times where, you know, it's easy enough to overlook. you know, I have an intense gratitude to all of the performers that go out and really just break themselves in half, entertaining me and everybody else. But, on some level, I'm always looking for that sort of sweet spot where they can live long and healthy and productive lives, and, 6-year-old kids can be entertained their whole lives too.
How do you marinate in someone's life to write an obit on them, like you did with Piper and like you've done with others?
It's just a lot of immersion. I mean, the best thing about wrestling is how much of it exists online, and that goes back to even the earliest days of the internet. There's a link that gets passed around every once in a while that, like, the list of WWE employees' Wikipedia page is the second most edited page on all of Wikipedia, like, behind, like, George W. Bush's page or something. I mean, it's, like, it's insane how active wrestling fans are online. And it's not just, like present tense, like, you know, it's not just some 17-year-old who's, like, really into correcting things on Wikipedia. I mean, there's also this, like, massive communities of old-timers on message boards who just will, like, regale each other with stories of the old days, and you just have to uncover it. So, the first thing I do is just start playing videos on YouTube or on the WWE Network, which, is amazing just to be able to watch things in slightly higher definition or much higher definition than what, you know, YouTube sometimes has. And I just start Googling and so there's certainly some guys of some wrestlers for whom I know that there's a book that I have that I want, that I'll look them up in or that kind of stuff. But mostly I just go as deep as I can on the internet and read everything. I was talking a while ago about how everybody sort of BS's each other in the wrestling world, and that's sort of, I feel like, one of my obligations is to read all the conflicting stories and just sort of discern, at least for me, what the truth is. I mean, and sometimes presenting all the options is the best way to do that, and that in a lot of ways reflects the wrestling world the best. But you read so many stories about people, you watch their old footage. You watch shoot interviews, which if anyone is listening to this that is not a wrestling fan, I mean, there's this incredible culture of, you know, semi-retired wrestlers just, like, talking crap about everything that ever happened in their career. That's like 2/3 of YouTube, as far as I can tell. There's so much stuff out there, and with someone like Piper, you just dive in and hold yourself up for 2 or 3 days and watch as much as you possibly can, and then start figuring out the direction, the direction that you know a retrospective is going to take.
Kevin Nash, master of the shoot interview.
Yeah. I mean, and he's one of the best because he was one of the first guys to figure out that, like, you don't have to burn bridges when you do them. If you're just yourself, you know, that it's okay. But if there was any way that, like, there was some sort of, like, angelic lie detector that you could prove everything true or false just when somebody was saying it, Kevin Nash is one of the most entertaining guys in the world, and he's probably true, honest more often than he's dishonest. But I don't think many of these guys, I was going to say he's dishonest a lot of the time, but I'm going to correct myself. I don't think most professional wrestlers are deliberately dishonest. I just think that they have fully absorbed this kayfabe to a degree that is kind of hard for civilians to understand.
Yeah, I think that's well said. All right, I want to ask about Piper, and then we'll get into some sort of quick current wrestling scenarios. You know, as I've said, or as I wrote very briefly, not as well as you did in my column, Roddy Piper was my favorite wrestler for a number of reasons. But I think most of all, it's because he was always sort of authentic and true to his character. He was an anti-hero maybe before the anti-hero was big in professional wrestling. He was the forerunner for a lot of the modern guys like CM Punk in terms of the ability to use the mic to really get the crowd animated. He sold first. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, certainly. He sold WrestleMania 1, I would argue, better than Hogan in Mr. T did. As Piper famously said, nobody would have showed up to cheer Hogan if they didn't hate Piper as much. And even like sort of the reality of Piper is he even fought with the McMahons away from the ring, you know, and I think they even recently as right before he died, they pulled his Legends contract out from under him, or they didn't re-sign him. So there was a lot of interesting authenticity to Piper, even though he wasn't perfect. I just found the guy. I found him hypnotic when I watched him do promos, and I found him interesting to me because he was not as brawny as Hogan or Luger. He wasn't an acrobat like Steamboat or Macho. He was sort of just an really good, in-shape, fascinating performer. And when I read your tribute to him, I sensed that there was a lot of you had a lot of love for Piper as well when you watched. What was it about Piper that just seemingly attracted him to so many, even when he was a bad guy?
Yeah, I mean, you explained it. It's he was just the most intrinsically honest guy on the screen, and it was hard, even though we booed him because that's what we were supposed to do. It was impossible to not associate yourself with him, right? I mean, you looked at, you know, when you're a kid, and I'm speaking very broadly here, you know, Hulk Hogan is a superhero. He's a, you know, he's a demigod. I mean, he is your idol, but he's not. There's no world in which you're going to be Hulk Hogan. You know, I mean, and that is actually like that was literally the storyline of Rowdy Roddy Piper, right? I mean, he was never going to get it to break the glass ceiling and be a world champion. You know, I mean, the Hulk Hogan was the institution, and all he could do was try to turn, you know, a weekly television, you know, a weekly talk show that was, you know, 5 minutes long into a stage to get him in the ring against Hulk Hogan to necessarily lose. And that is, you know, it's impossible not to sympathize with the guy, even as you're booing him. And you're right. I mean, he tried. I mean, he was just, his entire career was just a series of people sort of miscasting him or kind of underestimating him. And you know, people were just like, we're just going to make you an announcer. We're going to make you a manager. And then him just like, you know, fairly quickly clawing his way into the main event as a wrestler. And he did the same thing in the WWF. You know, I mean, he was hired to be the mouthpiece for Paul Orndorff and Dr. D. David Schultz, who famously got fired for smacking John Stossel.
Right.
And Piper just put himself right there in the spotlight. And, you know, you say he was, you know, not as big as some of these other guys, not as athletic as some of these other guys. I mean, that's true. But go back and look at him. Go on YouTube and look at him when he was in Portland. I mean, he looks like your friend's kid brother in the backyard wrestling in his underoos, you know. I mean, he put on a lot of weight, and he was a supreme athlete. I mean, he won a Golden Gloves championship. He was, I think, a black belt in judo. You know, when he was training with Philip Bells out in California, he was really, really good. And he has a sort of, I mean, this is sort of like just purple prose, but he has a sort of feline athleticism that you see just on occasion. You know, there I talked about WrestleMania 3 when he starts walking into the ring and then turns into a jog. And the crowd just goes nuts because he's jogging, you know, and you can just see in the way that he moves that he's a real athlete. And a lot of his, you know, he didn't wrestle like Savage or Steamboat, and a lot of that was deliberate because he thought that, you know, he kept it on the ground. He used the rules that, like, Andre the Giant uses to sort of to lend sufficient awe to a giant. He used that as a guy who was, you know, 5'10". Because he felt like if he flipped around too much, then nobody would take him seriously in the other direction. But he was incredible. I mean, he was absolutely great, and he was his entire career the most forthright and honest person, you know, on the wrestling on the TV show. And he, you know, you're right. He was meta. He was an anti-hero. He was the cool bad guy before any of those things were concepts that people would have been talking about.
That's well said by you. All right, as we I'll give you 1 minute or under on, and we'll just roll off a couple different wrestling questions that I got asked and for you, and that I have for you. First, will Hulk Hogan ever come back to the WWE in some form or fashion?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
I mean, wrestling. There's never the end in wrestling, you know. I mean, we're talking about Piper's Legends contract. I mean, I was going to, like, from what I know, sort of from Piper's side, he and Vince hate each other deeply, but I would really kind of have a hard time reporting that as a concrete fact, because like it wouldn't surprise me at all if he were still alive to see them hugging at WrestleMania next year. You know, I mean, Vince views every human relationship through a sort of business lens, and I think that there will be a point in time where the best business decision and maybe the best human decision is to forgive Hogan. As difficult as that was for me, and as reprehensible as the comments that he made were, we've forgiven other wrestlers too for other things. You know,
will the Rollins title change prior to next year's WrestleMania?
You mean will he still be champion at WrestleMania?
Yes.
That's a good match. The last my prediction was that WrestleMania will have Rollins and Reigns and Ambrose, the three former Shield members, in a triple threat for the title. But my bet would be that he won't carry it straight through till then.
Interesting. Will we see Sting at next year's WrestleMania? And if so, what scenario do you see him working?
I mean, I think so. It's really hard to tell it's really hard to tell to what degree, you know, the mockers at WWE care about Sting. It almost feels at times like they brought him in last year just to sort of make people stop talking about it.
Right.
But, you know, there have been a lot of rumors that he's going to be involved in SummerSlam, but the specific one was that, you know, he was going to get tied up with the Undertaker, and I don't see that happening then. He'll probably be at WrestleMania. It's WrestleMania. I mean, they're going to fill up Jerry World, you know? I mean, that's the plan. They're going to have to bring out every single person. I mean, if you've ever main evented a wrestling pay-per-view and you're alive, you are going to be in Dallas next April or whenever it is.
So maybe Stone Cold, we'll see in some form.
I guarantee Stone Cold will be there. I don't think he's going to wrestle, but he'll, you know, they wouldn't try to do a big show in Texas like that without, you know, offering him lots of money to be there.
Who's the next great talent from NXT who's going to come up?
You know, there's a bunch of people down there who I think are really great. I mean, I love Sami Zayn to death and wish him well in his recovery. But I mean, I've been saying for a little while that I think Finn Balor is the most sure thing that they've had in developmental since, you know, John Cena. I mean, he's if they don't make that work, then, you know, they've really, really messed up.
What are your thoughts on the Diva Revolution? And do you like the direction that it's going right now?
I love it. I mean, I love it so much. I mean, for a lot of wrestling fans that just grew up watching on TV, they haven't been exposed to that much great women's wrestling over the years. Although, you could make a case that any Wendi Richter versus Fabulous Moolah match is better than what WWE's been putting on TV for the past decade. But you know, anybody who's gone to an indie wrestling show and seen two women really go at it, who are good at what they do, knows that this is just, I mean, the distance between that and what was going on on WWE television for so long was just an embarrassment, especially in an era where, you know, women's sports were really taking center stage in a lot of instances. So, you know, you can make your joke about WWE being 5 years behind the curve in this situation, but I think applaud them for doing it and appreciate what we're getting, because there are, you know, legitimately six or seven female wrestlers in WWE now who are, you know, in the top 20 of, you know, regardless of sex or gender in the company. And they are finally getting a chance to go out there and show everybody what they can do. And it's just so wonderful to see.
Your podcast, Cheap Heat, does extremely well when it comes to podcast rankings. And the one thing you notice when you look at the top iTunes charts is how many wrestling content podcasts do well, whether it's Flair's, Piper's was always in the top 15. I'm sure yours is. I'm sure I'm missing Steve Stone Cold. I'm probably missing, you know.
Yeah, Jim Ross. Yeah, there's a
Jim
lot of
Ross. Them. I'm you know, apologies to the people I didn't
Chris
mention.
Jericho. Yeah, there's a million
yeah,
of them.
I am Jericho. So my question is why is that? Why, you know, you would think that okay, maybe there's two or three people listen every week, but it's amazing that there's like 5 to 10 to 12 podcasts that traditionally rank in the top 100 on iTunes and podcasts every week. The demand for that medium when it comes to wrestling content seems insatiable.
Yeah, I mean, we really didn't talk that much about wrestling fandom, which is you know, a direction that my conversations often take, but there are very few, there's nothing else like being a wrestling fan. Now, it's possible to be a casual fan, but if you're a serious fan, I mean, there's nothing else where there is a live 3-hour show, you know, every Monday night to continue. You know, you can be a Game of Thrones fan. That's 8 or 10 weeks a year,
right?
You know, and for those, for those 2 months, you're on the message boards every night afterwards, and the whole week in between, just trying to figure out storylines and trying to figure out what they're teasing. This is nonstop for wrestling fans, right? So. And you know, for a lot of wrestling fans, that's how we identify first and foremost. So, you know, if a new episode of the Stone Cold Steve Austin podcast comes out and he's talking about what happened on Raw and he has a strong opinion, I mean, every wrestling fan is going to have to listen to it to be able to talk about it to their friends, right? I mean, it's a nonstop, very like intense community, and so I think that's a great thing. Now, I would love an off season so I could like go on vacation and not check Twitter, but and also for the health of the wrestlers, I've written about that at some length, but you know, the relentlessness of it is part of the business model, and I think it works for WWE, well, it works really well for them, but all of the spinoff things like these podcasts, and I mean they reap the benefits too. And I think one of the underrated things is so many wrestlers are, I mean, they're doing a different kind of acting than Hollywood acting. I mean, the transition from the wrestling ring to Hollywood is not a very smooth one for most people not named The Rock. But they are immensely talented talkers. And, you know, for anyone that watches wrestling and thinks that these guys are just being hammy and they're doing something that anybody can do, I mean, let me assure you that you're very wrong. I mean, every time you see, you know, they'll have movie stars that come on Monday Night Raw to promote their movie. They get in the ring in front of 18,000 people or whatever, and they try to sort of interact with the wrestlers as if they're part of the script, and they make utter fools of themselves
right.
Every single time.
Right.
Because these professional actors cannot do what the wrestlers are doing, let alone the athletic portion.
Yeah.
But the whole point is to say, these guys are really good at podcasting. You know, I mean, it turns out that, like, Stone Cold Steve Austin is, like, one of the best broadcasters in America. I mean, who would have guessed that? But
yeah,
it's true.
That's a great – I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say, interestingly enough, I thought Jon Stewart actually is one of those guys coming in from the outside was pretty good.
Well, you know what? He actually does he's better at it than almost everybody else because he watches wrestling regularly, I think, with his kids. I mean, right. he's like – and what he's doing actually is in a lot of ways closer to what wrestling is. You know, he's doing a sort of outsized – pantomime of a newscaster, and that's sort of what wrestlers do, is like, you know, just pantomimes of professional athletes.
All right, I got three more for you. We could seriously go for like 2 hours more on this because I'm fascinated by this, but I'm gonna let you go. I don't want to hold you up forever. How long can The Undertaker legitimately draw as a main event kind of guy?
It's interesting. I mean, when people were fantasizing or fantasy booking whatever about him versus Sting at WrestleMania next year, I said, you know, I would have loved to have watched Undertaker Sting 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but I really don't have any interest in seeing it now because I just don't think either of the guys is good enough to carry the other guy, and both of them, you know, are at the age where they need somebody who can really, really work across from them. That said, everybody disagreed with me just about and said that they, no matter what, they wanted to see those matches. So to answer your question, I mean, Undertaker could draw as in, like, you know, get people excited, draw people to the arena for the next 50 years, you know. I think functionally he's going to wrestle through WrestleMania and be done. I mean, maybe it'll tail a little bit longer after that if there's, you know, a retirement tour or something. But I think that you know, I think that he's got, I think, you know, he's from Texas. He's going to go out knowing that he did everything he could for WWE, the company that made him a star, by helping them sell out, Cowboy Stadium, and that'll be it.
I love Stephanie McMahon as a performer. I think they actually underuse her. What are your thoughts on her when she gets behind the mic?
She's the best. She's the best heel in the business. I mean, because she is everything that every archetype that every wrestling villain has tried to play over the years. That is actually who she is. And I don't mean that she's evil. I just mean that she's rich. She's entitled. She plays this sort of blissfully unaware demonic character without even breaking a sweat. She's really, really good. And she actually got the benefit of I don't know if that's the right word, but she grew into this character on screen. I mean, when she first came out, I don't know if this is Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours thing, but she put in a lot of reps of being bad on screen before she figured out how to be good on screen. And now, I feel like this is an interview I would love to have, but they would never actually fess up to it. But the way that she and Triple H have literally changed the way that being a bad guy works in modern wrestling is really, really significant. I mean, they figured out when Daniel Bryan was making his run to WrestleMania 30, which he where he won in the main event, I think WWE around that time realized that the cruelest thing you can do is to listen to the fans and let them know that you can hear them and then do something different. And they just relish in doing that in front of live audiences almost every week.
Yeah, that's well said. All right, final two here. And I realize, I think I might have heard this on your podcast, that you think maybe the current line of promo is being played out a little bit. But I must say, as someone who became a wrestling fan because of promos, because of in-ring kind of mic takes, I love Paul Heyman you wrote this pretty perceptively a couple months ago. For a while, his promos were, in my opinion, carrying Raw. They were not just the best thing on Raw. They were oftentimes the only watchable thing on Raw.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a brilliant mic guy. Maybe he needs to sort of figure out something more than just coming in and continuing to reemphasize how tough Brock Lesnar is. But he's fascinating to me in that, at the age of whatever he is, early 50s or something, he's become this cult hero for his ability on the mic. The guy does nothing physically, but he's a genius when it comes to mic work.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a piece, I think you were referencing a while ago, where I said he was the most valuable player, basically, in WWE. And
yep.
That my argument was if you can argue that Brock Lesnar is the top guy in WWE, even though he can't complete a sentence when he's holding a microphone. If it's purely the physical aspect, then if you're going to give somebody that title for only having half of what makes a good pro wrestler, then Paul Heyman has the other half in spades. Now he couldn't do a dropkick if you gave him a year to train, but he's just the best talker in the sport. And you're right. I think my podcast partner Peter Rosenberg said that he was just sort of there was a point where he's heard this from Heyman enough times that he's sort of tuning out. I mean, I think that's sort of part of that's just wrestling has to be so many things to so many different people every week, in 3 hours and everything fits a certain niche. You're not always in the mood for the thing you're watching right at that moment in time. But, there's going to be more variation in Heyman's character. Right now, WWE is in hype SummerSlam mode, and they sent Paul Heyman out there on Monday to do what he does better than anybody else, which is explain in a way that makes you very emotional and what makes you very angry and very excited at the same time. He has to explain to you why the match between Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker at SummerSlam is the most important thing that you're going to do in the next month.
Right.
And he's better than that than anybody else.
All right, and finally, David, as we end this, what is your all-time favorite finishing move?
Ooh, that is really, really good. I mean, that's really tough, because the guys that I love the most I'm not a fan of the Von Erich claw. Not a fan of the drop kick off the top rope. Jerry the King Lawler was one of my first idols because I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and so his pile driver is pretty great. My favorites in WWE were Mr. Perfect and Macho Man Randy Savage. There's some sort of like weird platonic perfection, no pun intended, to that perfect plex. But I think that I just got to go with the obvious one and say the Macho Elbow. I mean, that was there was really nothing prettier than that.
That's a good one. I once heard Hogan actually on an interview say he wished that the leg drop did not become his finishing move because it probably would have saved some years on his body.
You know, it's funny. I mean, Macho Man, obviously, he slid into it like only a former minor league baseball player could have, but he landed on his side so many times that had to contribute to his hip problems as he got older. So you look at Mick Foley now. I mean, he does it. He puts up a good front, but the guy can barely shuffle along after all the times he jumped off the apron onto the concrete floor. And we talked about Stone Cold Steve Austin earlier. I mean, I honestly believe that he would be wrestling at WrestleMania next year, except for the fact that he has one of those back conditions like Michael Irvin or whatever, where it's like, right, you know, one more hit the wrong way and that's it for you. And, his life is fine otherwise. But the thing is, he can't – Stone Cold Steve Austin without the Stone Cold Stunner, which is jumping straight up in the air and landing on your ass, which you can't do if you have spine issues, and are risking paralysis. Without that move, what's the point of him coming back almost, So it's I think there's a lot of guys that would do well to reconsider what's going to make them famous if they want to be doing it for – I guess, no wrestler thinks they're going to be wrestling for 40 years when they start out when they're 20, but that's just sort of the way that we fans interact with these guys as gods, as icons, as superheroes. I mean, there's sort of no limit to how long we're willing to watch them as long as they, as long as they affect us in that way.
All right, I've kept David for an hour, and that is it. I'm letting the guy go back to the rest of his life. David Shoemaker is the author of The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Pro Wrestling. You can get that on Amazon. If you've never read it, I highly recommend it. He's either a staff or a senior writer, whatever the title is, for Grantland. You can catch his work on that website. It's terrific. As someone who is a huge fan of wrestling writing, it's as good as I've ever read, and I always look forward to when his stories come out. So I was very excited to get him on the podcast. We'll definitely do this again down the road, maybe around WrestleMania time, because I could talk about this forever, and the journalism part of it is really interesting to me. So, David, continued success. Good luck with your Cheap Heat podcast as well, and thanks so much for doing the Sports Illustrated Media podcast.
I really appreciate it, man, and I really appreciate you putting your podcast's life on the line in this match, because there's going to be a lot of subscribers that are mad that you're talking to a wrestling guy. I'm just going to warn you.
That's all right. That's fine. We can handle the heat, as we say yeah. Here. David, thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you so much, man.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks again to David Shoemaker, our guest. As you can imagine, I could literally talk about this stuff forever. Call me an escapist. Call me perpetually stuck in my 15-year-old adolescence. This stuff is just fascinating to me. I find the writers of the WWE and other wrestling places, they're the ones who do it great. They're like fiction geniuses to me, and the performers, especially on the mic, are amazing. These are very talented people. Wrestling does a lot of ills. I would never sort of run away from that. It's got certainly a racist history, and certainly drug use and stuff like that, steroids, but it's a fascinating world. And David Shoemaker really covers, I shouldn't say covers, but really sort of observes this world about as good as anyone I've ever seen. He's a terrific writer. I really enjoy reading his stuff, and I was really happy he came on the podcast. All right, we thank you so much for all your feedback for this podcast. It's been terrific. You can reach me on Twitter at Richard Deitch, RichardDeitch. Suggest any podcast guest you want. Make any suggestions about the show. Feel free to yell at me or my producers about something we screwed up on. We can handle it. We can take the heat, as the wrestlers would say. And we enjoy the feedback, which has been terrific. We'll be back next time on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast with another guest. Got some really good guests lined up for September. Don't want to give them away just yet, but they're going to be good. So for our producer, Bette Marston, our producer, Jamie Lasante, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.